Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program online at carthage.edu/aspire. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Last week, we had the pleasure of speaking with Corey Mason, the mayor of the city of Racine. Today, we are happy to be speaking with John Antaramian, the mayor of the city of Kenosha. And needless to say, what will occupy our time for the next few minutes is COVID-19 and Kenosha's response to the COVID-19 crisis and what the mayor sees in terms of what is in the foreseeable future, to whatever extent any of us can know what is in the future in this time of COVID. Mayor John Antaramian, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
I'd like to hear first from you just a word on how you and your closest advisors and other people in the city's administration have been functioning during COVID-19, and what has this period of transition to virtual operation been like for you and your colleagues?
It actually has moved along fairly well. I mean, like many people, I'm of an age where I'm not excited about everything being done by technology, but that's kind of one of those, always an internal joke. As much as I know how much technology is important to us, I'm like many who just don't necessarily like not being able to look at someone in the eye and talk to them. So it's difficult on that basis, but it's also the reality of what we're facing today, and we need to be smart in what we're doing. And so that, to me, is one of the big keys as to what we've done and why we've done it. So in the case of city government, we have limited the access to the buildings from the public. Museums and libraries were closed. We are limiting what people, we're trying to keep as many people at home, working from home. And so that is one of the things. This building itself, City Hall, is fairly empty in the sense of staff that are here. There are some, but it's a minimal crew, and it rotates out, and a lot of people are working from home, and that's what needs to happen. And so from that perspective, I think we've done well. We've controlled the incidence of the virus within government itself, and we're now facing the issue with the virus on a citywide and countywide issue that is much broader and much more impactful at the present time.
Before we get into the specific decisions that have recently been made involving the city of Kenosha, I'm curious how much you have done in terms of consultation with your counterparts in other places. I know that that kind of communication tends to happen when kind of life is normal, and it rather easily allows for those quick phone calls or emails to other mayors and other places. During COVID-19, has that continued to be the case, or less so, or more so? How much are you in consultation with other mayors, particularly here in Wisconsin?
Actually, more so. In fact, this last Saturday, the five of the mayors of the major metropolitan areas had discussions, and we'll be having more discussions in the next few weeks as we go on. Because this is basically something we are setting up now on a couple-week basis, where we're talking about the different things that are going on in each of the communities and discussing what we need to do to deal with certain things. Because this is not going to go away. I know everyone hopes that this goes away tomorrow. It's not, though. And we're all going to be dealing with this for quite a while. And on that basis, how are we going to deal with elections? How are we going to deal with other type of activities that are going on? And so what we're trying to do is put together a logical process on how we're all going to handle things in a somewhat similar way when it comes to elections. When it comes to those things that we all do together, how are we going to handle them? What are our requests to either the state or federal government or to nonprofits? Those type of things are the things that we're now working on together. And I think that's very, very important.
Explain to our listeners, and I think it's really important that we be very, very clear about this. What has occurred with the city of Kenosha in the wake of the Supreme Court's decision involving the stay-at-home orders of Governor Evers and that extension, which the Supreme Court, in effect, struck down? Explain then, in the wake of that, what has occurred here in the city of Kenosha.
Well, since you talked to Corey Mason last week, he probably told you that the city of Racine has their own health department, and therefore their health department has maintained the closure or the stay-at-home concept in place, where the city of Kenosha does not have that situation. Kenosha is based on a countywide health department, and so the authority given to the health department by the state statutes is not the same authority given to a city. So the health department has control over what we will and won't do in general. Now, having said that, there are some things the city is now looking at through the state statutes that allow us to do some things differently, and we'll be coming out with some things shortly. On the council meeting coming up, we'll be announcing at least one item that we're going to be doing, and then we're going to be doing some others that will be a little farther down the road for implementation. But within the law as to what we are allowed to do. Health departments, however, have the control. So let me walk you through a little bit of what happens so that people understand. Because a lot of times people call the city and say, why aren't you doing this? And the reason being is we don't have the authority. So because only the health department has that authority. So here's what happened. You had the governor's stay-at-home order. It was 60 days. They then extended the rule or extended the time period through the Health and Social Service Director. The legislature challenged that extension and basically said that she can only do that by administrative rule and that the legislature has to have a veto authority over it under a legislative rule process. Whether you agree or disagree as to what the Supreme Court did doesn't matter. The Supreme Court is the final say. And the Supreme Court ruled that they were right, and the governor, or the HNSS director, did not have the authority to extend the stay-at-home, and therefore ruled out the stay-at-home order. The county, through the health department, immediately implemented the stay-at-home through the health department's powers, which everyone believed was the correct thing to do. Regrettably, the next day, the county's association came out, I guess, and stated to the counties that that is not true, that the counties don't have that authority, and that they are putting themselves at risk by doing so. And so the counties, after the county's association did that, the health department reversed its position on that situation and reopened the process so that people could open. The Attorney General now has come back with another decision from his authority saying, no, the county's association is not accurate. The health department does have some authority to do some of the things that it wishes to do. So that's where we're at. So the county has now come out with a proposal that literally is moving in a direction of guidance for the public as to what to do and what not to do. So some of what the city is going to be doing shortly is goes beyond guidance, and we will be putting at least one restriction in very shortly as to what we think needs to happen. And then then we'll look at what the guidance that the organizations come out with and see which ones we have any authority over, and then make a determination looking at the guidance that will be coming out at the end of the week and looking at what parts of that that we will actually attempt to incorporate into ordinance and require it. But that's what the city is going to be doing. So there'll be some restrictions that'll be placed on how operations will work, and that'll be something the city is going to do on its own.
And some of these announcements we will hear even within this coming week?
Yes, at least one of the announcements you'll hear within the coming week.
So at the moment then, ahead of these announcements, What is the situation, for instance, in the city of Kenosha in terms of restrictions on people's activities?
They're literally the only restrictions that are on the city of Kenosha at the present time, because we do not have the authority to do it without either my ordinance and or that, and even there, like I said, we're limited on what we're going to be able to do, because the state statutes give the authority to health departments, not to cities. And since we do not control the health department, that is not something that I can tell you is going to happen.
Right.
So what has been in place is the things that we have done under our own authority, which is we have, you know, delayed major events. We have basically canceled a whole bunch of activities that are large group activities. We're trying to do the best we can with maintaining some of the outdoor activities if they're small groups. That'll be allowed, like, you know, a wedding ceremony is something that we're going to allow in the parks. Things like that that are small, that will not be, and that we can require social distancing because it's in our park. We can make certain requirements because of that. So those are the things we'll do and have been doing, and that's why you've seen a whole bunch of cancellations. The other day I was with the Legion dealing with their Memorial Day service, and basically they taped it, and we're going to put it on TV for them, and going through a process, like things that we can try to mitigate large numbers of people, especially those who are older, since they are the most susceptible at the present time, and do those types of things that we can to keep people as safe as possible. But in the end, the only things that are going to be overly impactful will be as we take a look at what ordinances we're allowed to actually implement. And that's what we're working on now, is what areas of control the city has on its own. We're going to also make a recommendation to the Village of Pleasant Prairie as we put together some things, and to the Village of Summers, as since they have retail also, that all of us should look at doing some things together. But that'll be up to each individual entity. We do not control that, because
right,
we are not doing it on a countywide basis.
Right. A really interesting draft that was recently unveiled involved this kickstart plan to restart the local economy. And this was,
yes,
if I understand, a collaboration of city, county, CABA. What is your sense of the impact that has had? Are these recommendations that, as far as you can tell, are being taken seriously or not to the level that you would like to see?
I think the problem with all of these activities is that right now it's a draft. And so once the draft is done and they have an actual document, it is recommendations, not requirements. You're not required to do this. And that is where I think there is a concern from my aspect of what we're doing. I think that you will find a lot of good companies. They're just going to say, you know what? We help put these rules together. They make sense. We're going to follow them. But I'm also going to have a lot of people that aren't. And so I think you find that everywhere we go, that if it's not mandated in many ways, there are going to be groups and individuals and facilities that are not going to follow those rules. So do I think it's a good idea? Absolutely. Do I think that a lot of people are going to work very hard to make it work? Yes. Do I think it is going to be the solution by itself? No.
What would you say, Mr. Mayor, has been the impact of COVID on city operations, and how do you see that impact changing in the near future, if indeed some of the restrictions that have been in place can be even slightly loosened?
I think the piece that probably is the most difficult for people is the inability to have as much access to government as they should. I think that is a bit of a problem, though I will tell you that one of the things that has happened, it has pushed local governments to move a little quicker, and part of it is financial, but moved a little quicker to deal with more things online than they've done in the past, to the positive aspect of many people, and to some people who are not computer savvy, a little frustrating. So it's going to be a time frame of change. And, you know, we can't be afraid of change. I mean, I always joke about my technology abilities. The reality is that we all change. We have to change. This is going to create a paramount of change within our communities in the sense of how we do business and how we do things, not just today, but for the future. Because as these things have changed, as we implement different aspects of what we do and how we do it, you're not going to go back to the old way of doing it. So we're all going to be in for a little bit of change when this is over with. But at the present time, it's a question of how do we get through it? How do we make it work the best we can? And then to continue with modifications to make it work better.
What do you see as the impact on next year's budget? Surely you have at least a rough idea of at least the general nature of what that impact could potentially be.
Well, I don't worry about next year's budget. It's this year's budget.
Okay. Let's start with that then, yes.
Next year's budget will be what it will be. We'll take into consideration what's gone on. We'll look at what we believe is going to happen for the future, and that budget will be what it's going to be. I mean, is it going to be difficult? Absolutely. But for municipalities, every budget is different because we're under such strict controls as to how we do things, which is going to be one of the issues that all of us are going to face as we deal with the amount of people we need to do the things that we do. So, but that's the norm. We'll deal with that next year. This year, what you're going to see are revenues that have decreased, and therefore we are in the process of looking and modifying operations, how we do things, whatever we can to bring that more under control. We are talking with the state about getting some help from them and the federal government for the revenue losses that are occurring, but we'll deal with it. I mean, we have no choice. That is what we do. And so are we going to have shortfalls right now? Yes. 6 months from now, I'll know better where we're going to be at. But we will make it work. That's just the way it works.
We're speaking with John Antaramian, who is the mayor of the city of Kenosha. Just a couple other quick questions, and thank you for being so generous with your time. How would you assess the state of affairs when it comes to COVID testing in Kenosha? How extensive is testing at the moment? How available is it? And what do you hope can be done in terms of progress in that area?
Well, the issue of testing is you're going to see an announcement shortly. We've been working with the state and with the health department to expand the amount of testing that's going to occur. And so you'll see an announcement coming out on that very shortly. I'm very pleased that the state has been working with the city on that and that the health department has been working with us as to how we think an expansion of the numbers need to be in the sense of testing, and that we want to make sure we let anyone who wants to be tested so they can actually get tested, where it's been more selective as to people with symptoms and everything else. One of the expansions that we're looking for is that anyone who wants to be tested can come in and get tested.
Are you concerned that 2 weeks from now we are going to see a serious surge in the number of cases, given the behavior of people at the moment in this moment when it feels for some like things are opening and we are moving back to life as normal?
There's no question, in my opinion, we are moving way too fast for reopening. I would have much preferred a more step-by-step process than what we have right now. But again, that is not something that I necessarily can control. Though I am looking at, as I said before, we're looking at what things the city has the ability to do because of the Attorney General's decision. So we are now re-looking at that and looking at some other areas that go back into laws way back, things that probably haven't been used in a long time. So we're combing the books to find what it is we actually have the ability to do.
Right.
Beyond the normal things. If we go off the normal things, my powers are somewhat limited as to what we can do because the state has really targeted everything towards health departments, not cities.
Right.
So we'll do what we can. We're going over everything that we can. We do have, as I said, one issue that I've already made a determination on that will be talked about at the first reading for the council meeting. So that'll be there for So those type of things are going to continue to happen, and there will be a handful of things that I think we can do, and those things we will implement because that's what the law allows me to implement.
From a sort of philosophical point of view, I think one of the discussions that has occurred is about the choice between broad, sweeping measures that affect everybody everywhere in relatively equal measure versus responses that are more targeted to places that we would consider hotspots or certain populations that are especially high risk. Do you have a preference between, in a sense, those two approaches?
Actually, I think you have to do both. To me, the whole process, I mean, in the end, the only way we're going to get through this is, you know, everyone is hoping and praying there's going to be a vaccine that will be coming forward sometime middle of next year. Maybe people will say it's going to happen faster. I hope it does. But if you look at vaccines and how long it takes for them to develop, you're looking at, you know, probably sometime in February, March of next year if we're lucky. Maybe a little bit later, hopefully earlier, but probably in that time frame. The other piece that would be helpful is there are some drugs that seem to be helping dealing with those individuals who are in really bad shape on the respiratory side. There seems to be some promise on that. That would be helpful. Keeping tabs of the hospitals and making sure the hospitals don't get overcrowded is an important aspect of what we do and what we watch for. Those are all the things that when you look at it that we are looking to see happen. So when you look at testing should be done in two different directions. I'm sorry I got off on a little tangent there, but testing has to go in two ways.
Mm-hmm.
One, I believe you need an overall testing for everybody who wants it. Now, what you're going to find there is a good percentage of the people aren't going to come in negative, or will come in negative, not positive. But the ones that come in positive, we then need to go back and check out the family and make sure that the family is not covered. And if it is, then we need to isolate this person so that they're not spreading it to the family. And if it's a family issue, then they can go home and isolate at home with the whole family. We need to have some kind of a system. Now, we're not there yet. But I think overall testing becomes an important aspect of what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. At the same token, you need to have the selective testing. You need to know when there's a hotspot that we're going to go in and test the whole facility. Because if you don't, all you're going to do is keep on spreading it. So I believe the answer here is a combination of both. And I think we have to be in a better position come November that we have that in place. Because if we don't, we're going to be going through the exact same thing we're going through today, where the numbers are going to get out of hand, and we are going to find ourselves in a lot of trouble.
Hmm. Closing thought in the last 30 seconds for anyone in the community listening to our conversation. What is your single most important message to the people of Kenosha?
Well, I think the single most important, and I probably have been very depressing to most people today, and I'm sorry about that. I don't want to be, but I also want to make sure people understand the situation. So my most important thing is we can get through this, but I need people to make sure that they do what is smart. You know, the basic things. I always go back to, you know, do what your grandmother told you to do. Wash your hands. Do the things. Use common sense. Don't put yourselves at risk if you don't have to. Do those type of things, and that will help solve part of the problem. We will get through this. We are a resilient community. We will get through this. But people need to make sure that we use common sense. And yes, I know everyone is felt like they were tied up and couldn't get out. Think of your parents and your grandparents who went through World War II or went through the Depression, went through all sorts of different things. They did what they needed to do to make sure we get out to the other end.
Hmm.
We can do that too. So a little hope in the sense that common sense and we as a community can get through this. We just need to be practical and use common sense.
John Antaramian, the mayor of the city of Kenosha. Mayor Antaramian, I thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much. Best wishes to you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. The preceding interview was recorded with Mayor Antaramian yesterday morning. We want to give you just a quick update. During last night's city council meeting, Mayor Antaramian revealed that he would like the council to approve a measure to require that owners and clerks in retail establishments wear masks. A preliminary vote is expected to be held at a special meeting that will likely be held sometime this week. A final vote will come at the council's first meeting in June. A second measure, this one still in the drafting stage, would set capacity limits and physical distancing requirements. Also last night, Mayor Antaramian inferred that he was not happy with the county's decision last week to abandon its extension of Governor Evers' Safer at Home order after the Wisconsin Counties Association questioned the legality of local restrictions. Local restrictions, of course, came about in many areas of the state after the Supreme Court's ruling that nullified the state law. Mayor Antaramian said he wants to renegotiate the city's contract for service with the county health department, saying that the city needs greater influence over its operation. The mayor said that he will be sending county officials such a letter at some point. It's exactly 8:36. This is the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. Right down the road from us in Evanston, Illinois, lives a highly regarded author by the name of Scott Turow. And perhaps there is no other writer who has been more important when it comes to the legal thriller. And some would say that Scott Turow actually touched off the genre himself with his blockbuster bestseller back in 1987 called Presumed Innocent. And I believe he has written just under a dozen best-selling works of fiction in the subsequent years. And his latest novel is an important work. It's called The Last Trial. And it once again has at the heart of it a character who we first met in that book back in 1987, attorney Alejandro Stern. This time, Stern is 78 years old and about to be stepping away from the legal profession. In fact, in a sense, has already done so, but intends to step back for one more trial, the trial of a good friend of his, a Nobel Prize-winning doctor by the name of Kirill Pavko. It is a complex case and challenging on so many levels. And at the heart of this story is what it means to be part of the legal profession, and also some of the very complex questions that roam far beyond the simple matter of black and white, right and wrong, guilty and innocent. It's a beautifully drawn novel, which I have thoroughly enjoyed reading, and I'm tremendously excited to speak with its author. The book, again, published by Grand Central Publishing, is called The Last Trial. Scott Turow, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg, and I don't think I could have done a better summary in opening myself, so thank you for that. Really, job well done.
You're welcome. I don't think I mentioned in the biography that you are actually yourself also an attorney, and I wonder if you could just say a word about how your real-life experience as an attorney has folded into your work as a best-selling novelist. I mean, I think we understand on a fairly simple level how you understand kind of the workings of the legal system better than those of us on the outside looking in. But I suspect it goes much deeper than that in terms of what it, in a sense, gives to you as an author. What would be some of the ways in which this is essential to the work that you've done as an author?
You know, I've continued to practice law for many years now, and certainly not on a full-time basis. I'm a partner at a law firm called Denton's, which is actually now the largest law firm in the world. But I've done it because what took me to law school in the first place was a base-level fascination with legal questions. And you know, that continues. I've never had a case that bored me, and some seem more worthwhile in terms of the values they may promote in the world, like a lot of the pro bono work I've done. But I just find it inherently interesting. And so it's really being in the milieu of the law that's mattered most to my continuing to write novels, because at the core of me, the ferment that legal questions raise, feeds the novels and also the practice of law.
One of the things that comes up in this story, which we'll explore a little bit further in a moment, is the fact that that an attorney, in a sense, is most directly serving their own client, but that there is this other system of law that they are also serving. At the close of one chapter in the book, you have your main character, Alejandro Astern, thinking this after having a conversation, I believe, with his daughter. He has practiced for 60 years, believing that his duty to the law is even greater than his duty to individual clients. It would be catastrophic to his judgment of himself if his last acts in the profession took him beyond the boundaries he has always faithfully observed. I wonder if you could tell us more about those kind of boundaries that at least this particular attorney, and we would hope or presume that most attorneys set for themselves in terms of serving the client and yet also serving a greater common good, and the ways in which those two matters can sometimes come into conflict.
Yeah, you know, the public perception of lawyers is not, as you would expect, as complete as perhaps it should be. And the rules of the profession, legal ethics, which I know some people think is an oxymoron, but legal ethics require a lawyer to be a zealous advocate for his client, to do everything she or he can for the sake of the client, but within a set of rules. And I've always thought about this myself as meaning that the lawyer's got to save something for the next client. And I don't mean effort. I mean, if you take those acts that will destroy your credibility with judges, or with prosecutors, you have made a sacrifice, which, you know, may be damaging to your own career, but more significantly is damaging to the next client, because when you appear before that judge or you deal with that prosecutor, they won't trust you the way they have in the past. At the end of the day, as I like to say, every lawyer who likes being a lawyer, and it's a profession, of course, riddled with people who don't enjoy it anymore, but every lawyer who likes being a lawyer sees herself or himself as involved with doing justice. And that doesn't mean that it's a perfect outcome in every case, but it means that the rational and acceptable range of outcomes is the goal for every lawyer in every case.
Hmm. Some of what you said reminds me of another favorite moment from the novel when you write this, giving words to Stern's thoughts. But for 59 years, Stern has approached every case almost as if he, as much as his client, were on trial. Each day consumes his entire spirit. He will sleep fitfully as the witnesses take over his dreams. I can scarcely imagine what it would be like to be part of a profession that takes hold of you to that extent. And again, I'm sure that's not the case for all attorneys, but I wonder if you're speaking from personal experience there.
I'm definitely speaking from personal experience, and I have never managed the trick, which some people can do, of trying a case and then putting it aside when I finally get home late at night. But all I can say is I went to law school prepared for that, I had a friend in San Francisco. I was a young lecturer in the English department at Stanford when I decided I would go to law school. And Jim, among many friends, was practicing in the criminal area. I had friends who were prosecutors. I had friends who were defense lawyers. And I found all of it exciting as they described their lives. And Jim was one of those people who tried a case the way Sandy Stern does in the last trial. And he told me that every day when he got up at every morning, the first thing he did was go to the bathroom and stick his head in the cistern lose last night's dinner. And I was so excited about the law and the criminal law in particular that even that story somehow sounded good to me. And so, as I said, I can't complain about having struck the kind of bargain that Stern describes. And but there is there's nothing in my life that rivals the experience of having somebody's freedom depend on, you know, how you're going to perform that day and in subsequent days. And it comes sometimes as a true emotional hardship, especially, by the way, for the people around you, children, spouses often find it very, very difficult to live with somebody so consumed by his or her quest in behalf of someone else. It's a little like having to live with somebody who's, conducting an open affair.
You have Mr. Stern reflecting on his life at one point and thinking about the ways in which he has perhaps neglected those closest to him. You write, "The brute fact is that his energies and attention have often been entirely consumed by the courtroom, leaving less than he would have liked for the people he claims to love. All he can offer in response is candor. This is the life I needed to live." At 85, he is certain that without it, he never would have known himself. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with best-selling author Scott Turow and talking about his latest legal thriller, which is called The Last Trial. Its central character is an attorney by the name of Alejandro Stern. I think I misspoke earlier. At some point in the book, he's referred to as being 78, but he's actually, I think, 85 years old at the time of the primary events of this book, correct?
Yes, that's right. True. The 78 was when he was first treated by his friend, Kirill Pafko, who's the defendant's son is representing.
As I mentioned earlier, we first, that is, readers to your books, first met Alejandro Stern in your first novel, Presumed Innocent, way back in 1987. And here we are, and now he is 85 years old and nearing the very, very end of his legal career. It occurred to me as I was reading this book how refreshing it was to have a character at the central spotlight of such a novel be this elderly. That in and of itself is quite rare, as far as I can tell. And it's also rare to have a given character age this much, I mean, over the course of all of these books. I think it's much more common to have, to draw from my childhood, it's much more common for it to be kind of like the Hardy Boys, who
right.
are perpetually sophomores in high school for decades on end, because to change their age is to change fundamental things about who they are and why we like to read about them. You've made, obviously, a very, very different choice with Alejandro Stern. Tell us some of the issues that you are able to explore because you have allowed him to age and at this point reach the age of 85.
Well, you know, I have great respect, Greg, for my colleagues in the suspense genre who like to write, a series of books about the same character who, as you correctly point out, generally speaking, is changeless. And But for me, the interest in going back to a character is exactly the issue that you are pointing out, which is the Sandy Stern of the last trial is no longer the Sandy Stern of presumed innocent just because of the force of time. And, you know, and that becomes a motif in the last trial. Stern is always comparing himself in the courtroom to the younger Stern, and he finally faces the fact that no matter how good he thinks he is, and of course he performs admirably at many moments, the younger lawyer still was even better. And you know, so that's one issue, which is simply accepting what age has dealt, and you know, whether you're willing to continue that way. Stern is not. And beyond that, you know, the issue I think at the heart of the last trial, as I conceived of it and as I explained it to my editor when, you know, Grand Central agreed to publish this book several years ago, is how do you measure the value of a life by one's own terms and even by the world's? And Stern is representing his friend Kirill Pafko, who has won the Nobel Prize in medicine, and for better or for worse, is a famous researcher in the world of cancer, and also, by the way, a wonderful hands-on physician who, you know, proved himself as Stern's doctor to be incredibly empathetic. So how do you measure Stern's life, which has been of enormous aid to a small number of individuals that he's represented over the 60 years, versus a life like Pafko's, where he's had grand achievements, but has not treated the people around him with the kind of concern that Stern has felt. And, you know, this is the issue that looms throughout the trial and throughout the novel. And Stern delivers his own judgment near the end of the book.
I so appreciate the way in which the reality of his age is very much present in the book, but in a way that I never grow weary of. I mean it's not like kind of a drone we get tired of. It's an important reality and a fascinating reality. I mean, you show us different facets of it. And at one point in the book, you have Stern thinking or saying, in his dreams, he still runs like a deer.
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of us who are older than we used to be, I guess that's all of us are older than we used to be, but I think for many of us, that is the way it feels, that in some ways we feel like we are exactly who we always were, and then there are these other undeniable ways in which we are not the same. And Mr. Stern is contending with that time and time again in all kinds of different ways.
Right. And I mean, that is one of the things that we forget when we consider elderly people, which is that life as we experience it at its core, you know, this vital force that we identify as being us, that remains. And it remains almost until we draw our last breath. And so, you know, that for the aging person, like Stern in the last trial, that becomes kind of a perpetual enigma. How can I still feel so alive and yet be less capable than I once was? And I'm grateful to you for, you know, pointing that passage out, because candidly, it's one of my favorites in the novel.
I want us to spend just a couple of minutes talking about the case that is at the heart of this novel, namely this friend of Mr. Stern's, Kirill Pafko, a Nobel Prize-winning cancer researcher who is on trial for insider trading and essentially murder as well, because of a treatment he developed for cancer called G-Livia, and the charge is that he has falsified certain clinical data in order to get its approval fast-tracked, and then unexplained deaths occur, and the legal system descends on Mr. Pafko. I think it had to have been a challenge for you to explore some of the realities of cancer and research into treatment and approval and so on in a way that would be clear to the rest of us. Just how challenging was that for you?
It was challenging because, you know, the novelist and the trial lawyer have certain things in common, which is that you both failed in your job if the jury or the reader goes to sleep. And so how to present this information in a way that's both accurate and gives the audience some sense of the complexity of it, but without, you know, boring them to tears is of course, you know, a challenge. And, you know, my answer is to deliver it in small bites so that it can be chewed up and digested. But I hope, of course, I want everybody who hears your broadcast to run out and buy The Last Trial. But I hope for the people who actually do that, when they pick up the book, they will notice the complexities of the drug approval process, because we're talking a lot about that today, given, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic. And I know people are frustrated that, you know, certain drugs are mentioned as being, you know, successful in treating the disease, and we talk about how long it'll take to get a vaccine approved. But if you look at the specific circumstances of the case at the heart of The Last Trial, this is a medication that appears to be a panacea for certain cancer sufferers, and it's rushed to market, and then it turns out that a percentage of those patients are suffering a life-threatening allergic reaction. And, you know, the FDA, the Federal Drug Administration, is incensed because they approved the drug without knowing that. And you get into the question then of whether, all things considered, the drug should be on the market, and help cancer patients, knowing that the medication is a kind of roulette wheel where 2 or 3% of them are going to, drop dead unexpectedly and suffer a pretty terrible death through, this severe anaphylactic reaction, as it's called. And I hope that as people read the book, they reflect a little on current events and understand the real complexity of what faces the FDA. And, you know, do you put something on the market knowing it'll help many and kill a few? And that's a question. That's just a moral dilemma.
A difficult question indeed, and an important question. And I want to add that your book, beyond all that we've talked about, also is a very illuminating look at Mr. Stern's relationship with various members of his family, including one of the most fascinating characters in this book, his granddaughter Clarice. At one point you say, Stern's love for his granddaughter exceeds his understanding. Such a great line and a great summary about, you know, probably many relationships in which we love someone but don't fully understand them. That and so much more packed into the pages of this marvelously crafted novel, again called The Last Trial, published by Grand Central Publishing, and its author, Scott Turow. Scott Turow, I thank you for all that you've given readers over the years, and particularly this last marvelous novel. And I appreciate you joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Very, very best wishes.
Greg, thanks so much. And I do have to mention that not only are we residents of Evanston, we also spend a lot of time up around Paddock Lake and in your listening area. So thanks to you for all the time. I'm very grateful.
You're very welcome.